The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
I'm joined now by Colm O'Gorman, former director of 1in4, founder of 1in4, Alan Shatter, former Minister for Justice, Equality and Defence, and Louisa Meehan, Woodview HRM, HR and dispute resolution expert. And it's sort of with dispute resolutions is where we start, because a lot of coverage of Keir Starmer's visit to Ireland yesterday. Alan, as a former member of cabinet, I might start with you on this, because there's an unnamed senior government source that says, if the British want to get closer and get more rights, this is in relation to the EU, and become like the Norwegians, if you like, then their obligations will increase in tandem. And I don't think that's going to change just because Keir Starmer is a nicer guy than his Tory predecessors. Is there anything in the visit that is concrete and useful, or is that it? Is he just a nicer guy?
Well, what effectively...
Will you pull that microphone over towards you, Alan, if you
want? What effectively you have is, to put it in simplistic terms, is two recently newly appointed prime ministers engaging in a public bromance. I think any improvement in Anglo-Irish relations is a good thing. It's to the benefit of both countries. There's been a serious break in those relations and difficulties with them ever since Brexit reared its ugly head, and it was and the British people were misled into voting in favour of it. I think that it's widely recognised now across Britain, even on the part of many who favoured Brexit. It was a huge error. I think Starmer is anxious not to say they want to rejoin the EU, but to further integrate their economic relations again with Europe to overcome enormous difficulties that have been created for the UK by Brexit. The UK is our biggest trading partner still. It's an enormous trading partner. So anything that improves relationships is good. But there's a need for more than... Yesterday was a public relations exercise. Starmer may have went home happier than Simon Harris because England beat Ireland 2-0. So there was a minor victory there. But we need more realistic and deeper engagement and discussions.
But is that not an issue for the EU rather than for us? Are we not constrained in how far we can go in any kind of bilateral action with the UK?
We are. In the commercial area, we are. And the UK may perceive that Ireland is a backdoor into assisting them resolving their economic difficulties. And after what happened with Brexit, within the European Commission, there's no enthusiasm, I know, to re-engage renegotiating arrangements. But I think that Starmer will slowly, over a period of years, further engage with the European Union. He's made it his business to meet other leaders in larger European countries, leaders of Germany and France. And this is all part of a process. But in the context of the island of Ireland, in the context of no further difficulties on our island, in the context of further developing issues arising out of the Good Friday Agreement, there's a need to resolve hostilities. There's a need. The previous British government had a unique capacity to create unnecessary upset, even within both the unionist and nationalist communities in Northern Ireland, such as the legacy legislation, which is now being repealed. And there's a lot that can be done to the benefit of both countries by in a bipartisan way that doesn't get in the way of Europe. One thing to say, and I'll conclude on this, we have the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference, we have the British-Irish Parliamentary Assembly. And a lot of the, if I could put it this way, the vim and vigour went out of those institutions formed by the Good Friday Agreement. It is good that there's now a resumption and a promised resumption of a regular meetings of the British-Irish Intergovernmental Conference. And with different MPs in Westminster, there's a lot that can be achieved through the British-Irish through the British-Irish Parliamentary Assembly. So I think this is a useful initial step. A lot of it is PR, but behind the scenes, I expect it'll result in greater interaction between civil servants from the Republic of Ireland with those in the UK to the benefit of everybody.
Well, the phrase that is getting used an awful lot in relation to all of this is reset.
Yes,
I thought we had a clip. My apologies. Colm, the concrete element that has emerged, there's not a whole pile of concrete specifics to point to other than the general better feeling between the two leaders and the two countries. The concrete outcome is this annual summit, which is now going to occur between the UK and Ireland. Does that make a difference?
Well, I think it does for all of the reasons that Alan just outlined in the Irish-UK context. I mean, Ireland uniquely in Europe has, there are deep and established relationships that aren't just familial or political or, you know, there are deep relationships. We have the common travel area, we have all of those other different dimensions. So there's a reason for that relationship. But I do think on the PR side of this, and I agree with Alan that much of this is about a public relations exercise. But I think from Starmer's perspective, that public relations is much more domestic focused than we might recognise. So, yeah, I absolutely think so. I mean, I believe completely that Keir Starmer and the Labour Party would like to see a realignment or a new and closer relationship with Europe. But they have to, first of all, deal with, 10 years of the demonization of Europe in the national context. So all of these establishing of friendly relationships with other European countries, with other leaders of European countries, is also about portraying a friendly relationship between the UK and the rest of Europe to begin to create some kind of appetite.
As representative of Europe. I would have thought they see that being France and Germany.
But that's if we don't recognise that there's a wider thing happening here. I mean, as Alan said, you know, this is one visit. It's a particular visit. Keir Starmer has, since his election, been doing a lot of work to go and visit and be seen with and establish relationships with European leaders. And I think that's about selling the idea of a different kind, a more collegial, a more cordial, a more friendly relationship with Europe to the UK population, to the UK electorate, to begin to prepare them for the idea that there might be some realignment or some re-establishment of formal, closer relationships with the EU. I don't think it's going to be membership, because that's probably two decades away before Europe would even consider that, never mind the UK be ready for it. But I think the public relations dimension of this, from his perspective, is focused on a domestic audience. Remember that the Tories and others spent two decades making out that European leaders were demons who were trying to dismantle the British Empire, such as it is, and try to undermine sovereignty and anything that was
straight
good about Britain.
Right,
exactly.
Taxes.
So there's a job of work to be done to get people open to the idea that there might be some new relationship.
This is your specialty, Louise. You're into dispute resolution. Can it get resolved in one meeting? Does a day of good PR go very far?
It sets a tone, I think, would be what I would say. And a positive tone is always a good thing. Anytime that you're going into a mediation, if people come in and they're happy and willing to be there, even if they are in a very, you know, complicated conflict, that will enable a solution to be found. I think it's quite interesting that they're talking about the economic relationship, and they're talking about 120 billion euros worth of a trade relationship between Ireland and the UK. So yeah, we might be not quite as big as France or Spain or Germany, but 120 billion euros worth of a trade relationship is important to any country. And as a small business owner, it's really interesting if you look at what's happening for businesses in Ireland who trade with the UK or with Northern Ireland, or who potentially supply customers who have businesses in the Republic and in the North, and things are changing. You know, Brexit was an enormous shock to the system, but there are still ongoing changes that are taking place from an economic perspective and from a business perspective. So I think if we can shift that relationship to being a positive, friendly, you know, it's a bit of a bromance, to be honest. They seem very happy and chummy, which is great. But if we can shift it to a new era of cooperation and friendship, then that will be positive for us living in this country and across Europe. And we are kind of a gateway for the UK now into Europe.
And trade seems to have been at the heart of a lot of the activity yesterday, because the Sunday Business Post reporting that ahead of the football match, Harris and Starmer met with a range of companies that have trade across the two islands, like Dawn Meats, Glen Dimplex, yeah, and a number of others, as well as having the head of IBEC there. Alan, do you think there is any appetite, if this is seen as a sort of a rapprochement with us and with the EU, is there any appetite across European member states to see the EU or the UK make a comeback?
Well, firstly, on the trade issue, if I can just very briefly come back to that, what has clearly happened is that small businesses that previously exported from the UK to Ireland, and small businesses that exported from Ireland to the UK, for those small businesses, that trade was very important. But the dreadful administrative complexity now of goods travelling from Ireland to Britain and vice versa has resulted in many of them ceasing to engage in those exports. So from a British point of view, Starmer has an interest in trying to address that issue. Now, I think I come back to what I said in the beginning. This is a process. Starmer is reintroducing Britain to a series of European leaders, including our own leader, in circumstances where, for as Colm correctly says, for 10 years, the EU was demonised, was blamed for every British problem. Starmer has already made very important policy decisions, not just the Legacy Act, but the Tories were threatening to repeal the impact in Britain of the European Convention on Human Rights. That's now off the agenda. They're not going to do that either, or repeal it. They were going to withdraw Britain from it, to put that in a correct way. So this is a very important process, which over time, I think, will help European leaders' appetite. Politicians, leading politicians and political parties across Europe, to use the very simple, well-honed phrase, were utterly pissed off with everything to do with the UK, because not just post the Brexit or pre-Brexit narrative and post-Brexit impacts, the whole narrative demonising them, blaming for everything that went wrong in the UK. Of course, the reality in the UK is that the UK economy has been the economy that has least recovered from the impact of COVID. And the other political reality in the UK was that COVID actually covered up the detrimental impact of Brexit on the UK, because UK politicians were able to blame the economic wind down to COVID. So COVID actually provided a cover. COVID doesn't provide that cover now. The UK is doing worse than any other viable European Union economy. But of course, Boris Johnson...
Can I ask you, do you think that's recognised? Because when we look across at the States and you see the focus on Trump and whether or not he'll get elected, the underlying reality is you have 46% of people who are of that ideology, regardless of whether or not Trump is there. The same is true with Brexit. Even if you see Brexit being a failure, presumably you still have nigh on half the English population who share the views and outlook that brought it upon them.
I think recent polls in the UK have shown that there's an interesting number who say or confess that they voted in favour of Brexit, who now know they got it wrong. We'll get to Trump and the US elections later on. But you had a series of leaders, Johnson, Truss, who survived for all of 6 weeks, and Sunak, who all opted in to the demonisation of the EU. When Sunak came in, he presented as, if I could put it this way, a friendlier face, because the penny had dropped. But the Conservative Party could not admit that a process that they led into Brexit was a disaster. Just as the Labour Party, who were very reluctant and opposed Brexit, and then they opted into, were not going to change it post the Brexit referendum, purely for electoral opportunistic reasons. I have absolutely no doubt that there's a significant number of Labour ministers, Labour MPs, who would love, if they could overnight, to reverse it. But they need to go through a process with the British public where suddenly Europe isn't our enemy. Europe is our biggest economic partner. Europe is a partner with us in NATO. Europe provides for security in the UK. And by the way, within the context of Ireland, the issue that everyone is getting perhaps unnecessarily excited about, but which the government has dealt with extraordinary incompetence, is the migration issue and the asylum seekers who came to Ireland to escape the completely nonsensical and inhumane Rwanda policy that the British government tried to implement, which also happily has now been binned.
Colin, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, delighted that the Rwanda policy has been binned. It was an absolute obscenity. Now, I mean, it was also utterly impractical. It could never have succeeded. It delivered nothing other than cost the UK taxpayers, the UK people, a huge amount of money. But it had an incredibly disruptive and distressing effect on the international protection system.
Which was the aim, surely?
Well, no, the aim was to, as with everything that government or successive Tory governments did around that period, was to try to inflame public opinion around particular issues and then exploit that for electoral gain. I mean, that's everything that they did. But sadly, that's the way that an awful lot of so-called strongman leaders use and exploit the migration issue. There are incredibly complex and significant issues at play that need to be addressed in the context of global migration. And global migration is going to increase, not decrease. So we have to get serious about dealing with it, but we have to deal with it objectively. And the first thing we have to do is try and create a political and social and public environment where we can have a conversation about it without grandstanding hard men politicians seeking to demonize people who are seeking protection because they're fleeing persecution or are seeking a better life because they're living in poverty.
And you think this new Starmer-Harris relationship lends itself towards that, do you?
I would hope that it will to some degree. I think we have seen some change in attitude in the UK post the general election there. But like the Labour Party, the new Labour government still have what 10 years ago would have been considered a very right-wing approach on a significant number of issues, because they've been very timid for political reasons about rowing back on areas like migration and other issues.
We do need to take a break. We will be talking after the break about the scoping report in relation to what went on in religious-run schools around the country, and whether or not calls, as reported in some of the papers, calls by some experts to have that extended beyond religious-run schools should be answered, and also what of any redress scheme.
The Anton Savage Show. This is News Talk.
It is the Anton Savage Show with you until 12 o'clock. I'm joined by Louisa Meehan, Woodview HRM, HR and dispute resolution expert, Alan Shatter, author and former Minister for Justice, Equality and Defence, and Colm O'Gorman, former director and, of course, founder of One in Four. And it is to matters relating to why One in Four exists that we move now. We obviously won't be going into great detail about the underlying allegations that were revealed in the scoping report, but just to flag you that we are going to be talking about a topic which can be fairly traumatic if it impacts you. There's an analysis on the scoping report. There's an analysis on a lot of analysis throughout the papers on what now needs to be done in terms of redress. And there's a piece in the Sunday Independent that breaks down the numbers, and it says 2,395 abuse allegations. 308, the number of schools where abuse occurred. 2,217 allegations reported by male religious-run schools. 820 allegations of abuse related to 132 Christian Brothers schools. And 16 Christian Brothers have been convicted. Colm, this has been something, obviously, that has been significant in your life for a very long time. Were you surprised by the extent of the revelations in the scoping report, given the apparent sense that we had had the dam burst on this 20 years ago?
No, because we hadn't. And we had repeatedly failed to get to grips with the true extent of the issue. I can remember when I was campaigning for and then negotiating the terms of reference around the Ferns inquiry, similarly with the Dublin Archdiocese inquiry as an extension on from that, and others, talking about the need to take a very careful look at what was happening within our education system, because church and education, as we know, are deeply linked and deeply connected, and in many ways controlled and operated still to a significant degree by the church, but certainly across the 70s, 80s, 90s and up into the 2000s to a much, much greater extent. And I mean, I can remember in the Dublin Archdiocese inquiry, for instance, you know, it revealed more of what was happening within the education system. And Maeve Sheehan covers this to some extent in the Sunday Independent today as well, where she talks about the case of a group of offenders, of known offenders, who were sent to Ballyfermot by the Archdiocese of Dublin. They were known to be offenders. And of course, when somebody becomes a parish priest, they also, most of the time, up until relatively recently, became the chairperson of the board of management of the local school. And what you inevitably then saw was known offenders appointed to parishes, appointed chairpersons of schools, and then using that position to get access to children, remove those children from school and abuse them. And we saw that on a grand scale in Ballyfermot to devastating impact. It's one of the pieces that, despite our best efforts to get people to focus on it, got missed a lot of the time and people just couldn't pick up on. So I think it's incredibly important now that we truly get to grips with the prevalence of child sexual abuse and of violence against children within our society and across our social and state systems.
Was it unique in its scale to Ireland?
I don't believe so. I mean, have a look at the commission that was established in the UK relatively recently, or the Australian Royal Commission that was established, by the way, which looked to, I can remember meeting with parliamentarians from Australia who were involved in setting up that inquiry. They came over here to learn from what we got right, but critically to learn from some of the things that we got very wrong in the approaches that we'd adopted. They learned from that, and their commission, their Royal Commission, was a very good exercise. We now need to learn those lessons ourselves, both from our errors, but also from what they've done over there. So, no, I mean, one in four, when I established one in four, it was in the UK in 1999, and the name came from statistics that we were seeing in many, many countries that said one in four children will have experienced, one in four people will have experienced sexual violence as children. I can remember when the Savvy report came out here in 2002, the figure for sexual violence in lifetime was about one in three people, but for children it was 27%. So, sexual violence against children is endemic across our society and across most societies. And sexual violence against children is a crime that's possible because it's not a silent crime. I mean, this is one of the things that really frustrates me about how we think about this issue. You know, people talk about things being hidden in plain sight or, you know, everybody knew. I mean, or that this was an entirely silent thing. None of that's true. It's a lot more complex than that. I had never worked clinically, and I worked clinically with victims and survivors of child sexual abuse for some time. That's how I came up to found 1 in 4 in the first instance. I've never worked with somebody who's abused by a child who didn't speak of that in some way. And, you know, anybody who knows children, children don't always verbalize what's happening, but they manifest what's happening.
But that was the other thing.
And the question is, are we alert to it? Are we aware of it? Are we sensitive to
it? But so much of what happened in public. That's the other thing. There was an awful lot of testimony in this that said that it was known either by other teachers or was known by other members of the congregation or was known by parents.
Absolutely.
Or it literally happened in front of
people. In 2011, when I was with Amnesty International, we published a report called In Plain Sight, which sought to address that particular question. We looked at what's revealed by the Ferns, Murphy, Cloyne and Ryan reports about the nature of power and how it operates in Ireland in this context. And one of the questions that we wanted to answer, you know, people used to say, well, the dogs in the street knew, everybody knew what was going on. And what we established really clearly in that research, an excellent piece of research done by Dr. Carol Houlihan, who's now with Trinity, was that it's not true that everybody knew, but it's absolutely true that deep veins of knowledge ran through all parts of Irish society. In other words, there was sufficient knowledge across all stratas and sectors of society for us to either have to do something about it or to pretend it simply wasn't happening and ignore it. And sadly, generations of people ignored it. And what we need to do now is not ignore what we know right now. And that's why the Commission investigation really needs to...
I want to come to that in a minute on what exactly needs to be done. Louisa, obviously Colm has been immersed in this issue and this area for some time. As a lay person who hasn't been immersed in it, were you shocked by what the scoping inquiry revealed?
Yes and no. I mean, look, 1 in 4, I've heard of 1 in 4, and I know that the volume of violence against children in historically within Ireland has been very high. There were certain elements of it that deeply, I mean, it all deeply disturbs me, but there were certain elements of it that also deeply shocked me. One, for example, is a really, large piece discussed around David Ryan, his brother Mark, who has passed away, and a friend of theirs, I believe it was Michael. It's 22 years ago since they started going to the Guards. And it's 22 years that the issues that they have raised, and I'm not going to go into what happened to them, they've touched on it in the article, deeply upsetting.
Unspeakable, yeah.
22 years. And I suppose two things that stood out to me in relation to that is that when we talk about it, we think about stuff that happened in the 50s and 60s and 70s. That's a long time ago. It's in the past. It's historical. We need to address it. We need to redress it. But we don't think about it in terms of today. So one of the individuals, three people abused David Ryan. The third person who abused him was removed from Blackrock campus. He was living on Blackrock campus with children. He was removed in November of 2022. That is less than 2 years ago. And he was allowed to be there even though those allegations were known for potentially up to 22 years. That for me is unforgivable.
I mean, David, and first of all, I actually think David might be listening this morning, and David is heroic. He's an extraordinary human being, and Mark as well. They were incredible. David and Mark came to 1 in 4 in 2002, 2003, and you're quite right. Nothing that was revealed in the RTE documentary that kicked off this process was not known and not reported to the relevant authorities, both church and state. One of the most difficult things, and I'll speak personally on this, for me when the documentary came out, was that we were back here again.
Yeah.
That 20 years on, it took two people who had experienced these horrific violations to go public and to reveal deeply intimate aspects of their lives, not just what had happened to them, but the impact that it had upon their lives and was still having on their lives, for us as a society and for a state to respond to that. And it's not that they didn't know. They'd known every system, both the criminal justice system, the civil legal system, the political system, and the church authorities had known about what had happened to them for 20 years, and nothing was done about it. And for me, one of the pieces that I really hope people recognise this, and you it was there in the numbers that you read out. We talk about nearly 2,400 allegations. 149 extraordinary people came forward and gave personal testimony to the scoping review, 149. All of the other allegations were gleaned from the files of religious congregations. The congregations had this information long before the scoping review came anywhere near them. And this is an institution that for many, many decades denied the fact that this was even happening. And when they were forced to acknowledge that was happening, said, well, yes, I remember Benedict, when he was Cardinal Ratzinger, saying that this is a case of the corruption of Western society infecting even the priesthood, saying that this was a conspiracy against the church, all of this kind of nonsense. We've had nothing has changed in we need to recognize one thing when we talk about this idea of how do we get people to cooperate with Next Step Forward? Will the church cooperate with redress? Will the church cooperate with investigations? We need to stop talking about cooperation and start talking about accountability.
Yeah, I agree.
And as a republic, if our systems of law are not able to hold organizations who are responsible for extraordinary acts of criminality and the cover-up of that criminality in an orchestrated, willful and deliberate conspiracy, we've no right to call ourselves a republic,
Alan,
and we need to amend that now. They need to be held accountable, not asked to cooperate.
Alan, both solicitor and former Minister for Justice, your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, for me, I've been engaged in this for 30 years. I mean, Colm is one of the big heroes for what he did, and what he went through is appalling, and for his public revelations of what occurred. But the very first court case that was taken against the Catholic Church, the Archbishop of Dublin, and a named priest, Father Ivan Payne, who subsequently was criminally prosecuted, was initiated by my law firm as long ago as 1992, when the courageous Andrew Madden came to our offices, described for me the abuse, and described for our firm, I should say, the abuse that he suffered. And we initiated court proceedings. And I can remember when we initiated the court proceedings, we needed, because they were unique, there hadn't been similar proceedings taken in Ireland previously. There was difficulty in getting cooperation from a member of the Bar Library in the drafting of the proceedings because they said no one would believe the allegation. And we insisted the proceedings issue in the High Court, and the Archbishop of Dublin was named in those proceedings as a defendant because it was known through the information we received that Ivan Payne had been abusing children in two different parishes. It was known by the church authorities. He had abused Andrew Madden in one parish, and then the abuse was reported, my recollection, I'm going back 30 years now, he was then moved into another parish. And the Archbishop of Dublin was responsible for that, the then Archbishop of Dublin. So we issued the proceedings, they were extremely difficult proceedings. Andrew Madden would have been at risk of substantial legal costs ordered against him had they been unsuccessful. And ultimately, the church settled. And ultimately, criminal prosecution was taken against Ivan Payne, and it was in 1998, from recollection, he was convicted. At the time of settling those proceedings, the church demanded that the nature of the settlement be kept private. I'm not revealing anything now that I shouldn't reveal as the law firm that was involved, because Andrew Madden, in my view, correctly and courageously, within a year or so of the settlement, went public and said what happened. But I also recollect we got a letter of complaint saying that he was in contempt of court and they were going to threaten to bring him into court for being in contempt. Now, of course, they never followed that up, but that was the start.
But they threatened
but
the
also,
victim.
But also, Cardinal O'Connell, who was the Archbishop at the time, denied publicly that this had ever happened. There was no settlement. He denied the fact of the settlement. He lied.
Yes.
What's fascinating about that lie, and it's really instructive about the nature of the institutional church and how they engage with this issue, is when Cardinal O'Connell appeared before the Commission of Investigation into the Dublin Archdiocese that resulted in the Murphy report, he was asked, had he lied? And he said, no, he hadn't lied. I went, but clearly you lied. He said, no. He spoke to he spoke to a practice that they use, which is essentially the same as a child putting their hands behind their back and behind their back, right, with their fingers crossed and not lying.
Yeah. I remember that, but mental,
it's called mental reservation, and the commission explained it in this way, something like this: two priests are sitting in the parochial house, and they see a young man coming up the street. So Father John and Father Tom are there, and they know that the young man wants to talk to Father Tom, but Father Tom doesn't really want to deal with them. So when the knock comes in the door, Father John answers the door, and the young man says, "Is Father Tom at home?" And Father John says, "No, he's not at home," but reserves to his own mind the words, "to you," and that means that he has not lied. And that was the practice that Cardinal Desmond Connell, the primate of all Ireland, used to explain how he had not lied when he told a blatant lie. That is a practice within the Catholic Church at the highest possible level. And it is why one cannot believe a single thing that any church leader tells you when they deny culpability or responsibility for this cover-up and the fact that it is an orchestrated, willful cover-up, which has been repeatedly demonstrated.
So what then?
What was extraordinary, just to come back to this, what was, for a moment, because what was extraordinary about the Ivan Payne case was, by sheer coincidence, around the time when Andrew Madden came into our offices, I was doing what I did as a family lawyer, representing a client who had serious marriage difficulties, and we were dealing with it in the legal issues in the High Court. But she was before the Marriage Tribunal of the Roman Catholic Church, based in Archbishop's House in Drumcondra at the time, and she was seeking what was effectively a church divorce. Now, not a nullity, a church divorce. We'll get into that in other circumstances. And you had to be interviewed by someone nominated by the Marriage Tribunal of the Church. And it turned out that Ivan Payne, having been moved from one parish to another, in circumstances where there was allegations made to the church that he had been an abuser, he was engaged in private, intimate, and I emphasise intimate, interviews with individuals seeking either a church nullity or a divorce, in which they were being specifically asked detailed questions about the nature of their intimacy with their husband or their wife. So here was a known abuser placed within the marriage tribunal. Let me just jump to something else though for a minute. I was very familiar throughout with the history of all of this. And one of the things, and it's hugely relevant to this report, and it hasn't appeared anywhere, and I think Mary O'Toole, by the way, deserves enormous praise
because the senior for the nature of the report.
As, to be fair, as does Norma Foley, yes, who I think has been exceptional, and the way that this has been handled by government has been exceptional.
Sure, but one of the issues that no one has yet homed in on is very early on, I'm not praising myself, just a practical thing, when Minister for Justice, I had enacted a piece of legislation called the Withholding of Allegations of Child Abuse and Abuse of Vulnerable People. And what we did with that legislation was criminalise what I would describe as the concealers and the enablers. We criminalised the fact that because so much was known of church cover-up, and so much was known, we had all the preceding reports, including the Ryan report, a whole range of reports, so much was known within the church of concealment, that we created a criminal offence which is particularly applicable arising out of this report that I don't think has yet been adequately utilised. One of the problems is a lot of what's in this report is historical. Exactly. But
can I ask then, what is the whether it be criminal action against the abusers, whether it be criminal action under that legislation against those who didn't come forth when they were legally required to, whether it be a redress scheme, what now?
What now? Well, I think the Australian example provides a very good example of the nature of the exercise to be done. But I think, as someone who had the experience of being in front of a commission of investigation when there was a whole range of untruthful allegations made against me, which all dropped away substantially during the hearing, I'm very sceptical, I'd have to say, of these investigations being conducted in private. I think there's a need for a public element in this, but there's a need to look at the enablers and those who covered up.
Okay. We have that.
I think the first thing we have to do is to separate out the various elements of what we're trying to achieve here. So we absolutely need to separate redress out from an investigation process. I also think we have to, insofar as we possibly can, and I think there are ways to do it, separate out the idea that victims and survivors of abuse need to have their voices heard. We need to create a way for that to happen. But at the same time, we need to make sure that the commission investigation is focused on the systemic issues here. How can we best identify what happened? And I don't mean did abuse happen? We know that happened. But what were the responses of both church authorities at all levels and state agencies to concerns, allegations or suspicions of abuse? What did they do on foot of those concerns, suspicions or allegations of abuse? And what does that reveal about the relationship both between church agencies at all levels, including extraterritorial ones, so the Vatican and others, and state agencies here? We need to understand and unpick
and briefly,
all of that.
Colm, do and you what see the them as two parallel but separate processes, or is that one commission or tribunal?
So I think we can have a commission investigation that has a two-track element to it. So I think we've seen that before. We saw it within the Commission to Inquire into Child Abuse, which was a tribunal. We saw it within the Mother and Baby Homes Inquiry and others, and there were flaws in all of those processes that we need to learn from. I think a confidential committee approach that allows victims to come forward and survivors to come forward and tell their stories and have those heard and properly recorded in a way that allows informs that systemic investigation as well as captures that and hears people is incredibly important. But I absolutely think, and the commission investigation can do this, Alan is spot on. The investigation and the inquiry into these systemic issues, what happened on a systemic level, needs to be public. One of the most effective things the Ryan Commission did was it brought the religious congregations responsible for the institutions forward into public hearings where they were cross-examined and put to the pin of their collar by barristers for the Commission and others. That needs to happen as part of this process, and that must be public. That has to be public.
Yeah, I totally agree, because I think what this reveals is that the difficulties that weren't a few errant individuals. They were absolutely systemic. They were known. I also believe, and this has been an issue for many years, the Gardaí haven't come to terms with, that there was a form of conspiracy among some of these individuals in these institutions, and basically we had a morally bankrupt level of compliance.
And if I don't say this, Anton, I'll have really failed on one regard. I'll be really quick. The commission has to investigate all schools in the state. All schools.
Absolutely.
Colm McGorman is with us, former director and founder of One in Four, Alan Shatter, former Minister for Justice, and Louise Meehan, Woodview HRM, HR and Dispute Resolution Expert. If you want to get in touch, 53106, or you can get us on WhatsApp, 087 1400 106. This week is going to see the hopefully a presidential debate in the US that is slightly less momentous than the last one, because it led to the departure of one candidate. We look forward to that, and also to Conor McGregor's presidential campaign after this break.
The Anton Savage Show. This is News Talk.
I'm joined this morning by Alan Shatter, former Minister for Justice, Equality and Defence, Colm O'Gorman, founder and former director of One in Four, and Louisa Meehan, Woodview HRM, HR and Dispute Resolution Expert. If you want to get in touch, 53106 or 087 1400 106. This week is going to see Kamala Harris take on Donald Trump. And Louisa, there are pictures in the paper of the man who is acting as an avatar, as you call it, of Donald Trump, wearing the wig and 3-inch lifts so he'll even look like him in the debate prep.
I think, you know, they're saying that Harris is doing 2 to 3 different debates a day, and she's going up against somebody who is dressed like and acting like Donald Trump, so getting completely prepared. They're seeing it as her do or die moment and having her prepped to poke the bear. So I think it's really interesting when you read through all of the articles that they talk a little bit about how Donald Trump treated Hillary Clinton in their debate. And Hillary Clinton is a very well-established politician who's been around the houses, met international leaders, and she found, I think that the direct quote was something along the lines of that he made her skin crawl.
Because he followed her around.
It was really intimidating. And he's bigger and he's stronger, and it is very, very unprofessional. It should have been stopped by the people that were hosting the debate. It shouldn't be allowed, because that is actually a form of intimidation, and that is not a debate. That is trying to make somebody feel uncomfortable. And I think Donald Trump in this situation, he's up against a formidable component, because you had two dothery old men and he was kind of okay. He was a bit less dothery than Biden, and Biden's done what he's done and what have you. So I'm not questioning him, but he's now up against Kamala, who is looking quite young and youthful and energetic and has a very different appeal and a very different demographic. And
he is, though, unencumbered by any need to connect what he says to any facts, which does make debating easier.
Well, does it make it easier or harder? Because how do you tell somebody that they're factually incorrect when he tells you to drink bleach because of COVID? Sure, it might work. And then people go and die drinking bleach. I mean, that's how ridiculous some of his commentary has gotten in the past. So,
but my point being, in any other debate, if you're Kamala Harris, you say, aha, I will be able to debunk what he says. But the man is undebunkable, which is very difficult.
I don't think she needs to do that, though. I mean, I think the approach will be, the thing that has really worked for, one of the things that has really worked for the campaign has been Governor Walz's weird label, right? So I think what Kamala Harris is likely to do in this debate is just do everything she can to make Trump reveal his general weirdness. And that's what it's all going to be about. And you can see it in terms of how they've even presented that. I mean, who found out that the man in the orange wig was being, you know, where did that photograph came from? It obviously came from the Democrats. They've leaked this. They're trying to get under his skin already. They're going to mock him. They're going to belittle him. They're going to try and get him to reveal his extraordinary
strength. Does it even matter, though? I mean, surely they are so entrenched in both camps that it makes little difference.
It matters to the independent voters. This election will be won by very, very small numbers of
Louisa?
I think that's a concern I would have. I think that the US has become increasingly polarized. And when you have a country that allows children to get rifles and go into school and shoot other children, and you have lobbying groups that say, well, actually, our right to arms, in terms of Donald Trump, but our right to arms is more important than our right to protect our children, I think it's really concerning, because some people will support Donald Trump irrespective of what he does or what he says. You know, for me as a woman, I've always had a massive issue with him going in there, because based on what we know he has said, not what he has been accused of, we know that he has said and done things that as a woman I find incredibly offensive. And yet you still have almost 50% of that community voting for him to go into power. So I do think that Kamala has a massive
50% of white women, specifically. there's a real difference here, and it does speak to the point you made about how polarized the US has been. But the polarization is taken for granted. And as I said earlier on, this election will be won by very small numbers of so-called independent voters.
Louisa, can I ask you, though, because we tend to focus on the moral reprehension that circles the man. If you put that to one side, and I realize you have to swallow hard to do it, if you are a conservative Christian and you want to limit access to abortion, if you are a very wealthy person and you want to limit the degree to which you are taxed, and if you are somebody who believes that the government should leave them alone to do whatever they want in environmental terms or anything else, there's a good logic why those cohorts would vote for Trump.
No, there is. And some of the time, if you strip back the crazy and you look at some of what he's actually saying, some of the time you're looking at it going, that makes sense. That, you know, he is pro-America, he is pro-industry, he is pro-the-economy. He comes at it from a business perspective. He makes decisions that puts the American people's needs above the needs of any international relationships or any sort of sense of self-preservation. He doesn't seem bothered by what people think about him. He seems to be very committed to, this is what I think is the right thing to do, and I'm going to do it irrespective of what you think. So, you know.
Meanwhile, closer to home, there is news on our own presidential election, which is that Conor McGregor has described how he is going to act when he is president. It's sail by assumption. He has said that he would have the power to summon the Dáil as well as dissolve it when he is president, and he will call in these charlatans in their positions of power to be summoned to answer the people of Ireland and have it done by day end, or he would be left with no choice but to dissolve the Dáil entirely. This would be my power as president. I know very well, he says, Ireland needs an active president employed wholly by the people of Ireland. It is me. I am the only logical choice. 2025 is upcoming. Do you fancy his chances, Colin?
Oh, dear Lord. I mean, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, look at Brexit or look at Trump, I suppose. And we should never underestimate the degree to which, in a toxic or divisive space, somebody who's a massive disruptor, who will say wild things, can capture some attention. I don't think Conor McGregor is going to be the next Irish president. However, somebody needs to have a chat with him and speak to his delusions of grandeur in this. I mean, the tweet actually starts with, as president, I hold the power to summon the Dáil as well as dissolve it. So he seems to think that he already is or inevitably will be. I mean, it's extraordinary stuff. If he were to be elected president, I would imagine within about 3 hours, he'd be in for the biggest shock of his life when he realised that he has pretty much no power whatsoever. And all he can do is sit up there and stew and annoy people. For
the ensuing constitutional crisis would be
fairly
entertaining.
Yeah.
The other news, Alan, that I wanted to get your view on is €100,000 plus, we're told six figures, is heading in the direction of Leo Varadkar to write his memoir. Is there any aspect of that memoir that you would particularly be interested in?
Well, I wait and see what he writes, and good luck to Leo, you know. Could I come back just very briefly to the American election? Because I think the American election is a lot more interesting. I've just come back from 7 weeks in the States, and there's two or three things happening that are of great importance. Yes, Kamala Harris is a brilliant candidate, but the election is still neck and neck. Mm. Secondly, the debate. The supporters of Trump, it's become a cult. The Republican Party is unrecognizable from what it used to be. He delivers these long, rambling speeches that go on endlessly, like the leader of North Korea. Much of what he says makes no sense. He has no real policies. He makes up stuff along the line, and he is dedicated to untruths. Factually, if you check any speech he delivers, there's multiple untruths in a speech, not just what I describe as something some politicians regularly engage in, which is political exaggeration. Simply, it's BS. And the reality is that this election is going to boil down to what happens in seven swing states. And the current state of play is, in two of them, Kamala Harris is well ahead of him. In three of them, they're neck and neck. And in one, she is well behind him. And one of the best decisions she made so far was getting Tim Walz nominated as vice president, because she is very articulate and comes across very well. He is not just articulate, he's entertaining. And I think he's going to be a huge benefit to her on this ticket.
That is where we will leave it. Alan Shatter, former Minister for Justice, Equality and Defence, Colm O'Gorman, founder and former director of One in Four, and Louisa Meehan from Woodview HRM, HR and dispute resolution expert. Folks, thank you all very much.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.